Greetings and welcome to The Dividing Line. I don't have anything on the screen, so I don't know what's going on, but that's okay. It's just, it's that silly, that's not Windows 10. There, that, okay, ugh, there's that guy. I'd rather have the Windows 10 thing, or Windows 7, or whatever it is, I don't know. Better move the cell phone out of the way, because it does that little flashy thing, and that'll really bother people. We have some OCD people that watch, and that's why they couldn't handle the Borg light, which is now over here. I can have it, and it doesn't bother me, but I don't have OCD. So anyway, welcome to The Dividing Line. You know, every day is an adventure these days. It truly is. The world is an odd place. It truly is. You know, there are so many topics that I could address right now. And I'll be honest with you, how much pushback, detestation, anger can any one person take? I mean, there are a couple that I'd like to address, but I'll just be honest with you. I'm heading out of town. I've got my major yearly rides to do at high altitude and getting to go spend some time, some of my best friends in the whole world, and it means a lot to me. Speaking of three different churches in the Denver area, by the way. But I just, I suppose I could just light these fires and leave them all to Rich, and I just leave town, because he answers the phone anyways. And, you know, sometimes I'm over on this side of the office and he's on that side of the office. And now that he's a little bit closer, he moved his office. He used to be around a corner. I really couldn't hear anything. Now I can hear a little bit more. And so, you know, why not? You know, just flip the pins, throw the grenades and leave town. You know, maybe I'll forget my computer, drop my cell phone, whatever. And just have a couple weeks to relax and
do you find my conversation
insanity.
Do you find my conversations disturbing?
Well, you get some interesting phone calls. You get some interesting phone calls. You should have an automatic little thing that you press. You should have a little bank of recorded things. And, you know, like under one of Matthew 18, you know, and then just that recorded response to Matthew 18 and James White's a Jesuit, and you click that one, it might be a little bit easier. Or we could just have it as a part of the options when you call in. If you think James White's a Jesuit, press 1. if you're a King James onlyist and think that Steven Anderson and Peter Ruckman are God's gifts to the church, press 2.
But the response would be the same in each one. You are the weakest link. Goodbye.
No. No, there'd be all sorts of stuff. It'd be cool recordings. Don't you remember what we used to do with 266-2LDS and stuff like that? We could have some great recordings available for these. If you're a jihadi, press 3, and your call will be automatically traced and sent to the FBI. You know, it's just all sorts of stuff that we can do here. but I won't do that. I won't do that. But you do have the phone lines open, because not for calls. Hold on. Don't go crazy. I announced yesterday, and I'm going to discuss a topic other than the lynch mobs with the pitchforks and torches and effigies of me that are being burned across the internet by the religious and the non-religious alike. But I did throw out a open invitation. Now someone's going to have to contact Brother Flynn at Megiddo Films, because I just posted on Twitter that I'm blocked by Brother Flynn. I don't know why. Why would that be? I mean, he's felt the freedom to go after me on his program and for hours on end, and then blocks me on Twitter. It's really interesting. I've noticed, I've said a couple times, with only a small amount of exaggeration, that both Facebook and Twitter have had to bring entire new server farms online to hold Brandon House's block list. Because if you show any, if you express anything other than his perspective, he will block you. I mean, you're just gone. Boom. It's amazing. And so, yeah, somebody else in channel was blocked by Paul Flynn too. So, you know, that's his right. I mean, I've blocked people in the past normally because they were acting like complete jerks. But this is all being blocked, sometimes preemptorily. You know, just, I don't want to hear what you have to say. Well, anyways, someone might let Paul know. I included him and Osama Dakdok and Brandon House. You can call the studio here. I gave the number on Twitter. And here's the thesis of our discussion. The gospel was magnified and proclaimed in the dialogues in Memphis. I will defend that. You deny it. How's that? I've got it queued up. Ready to go. Paul Flynn knows that in the program he did with Mark Carpenter, they specifically stated that the gospel was not presented. What? No, it's not. No, I don't believe you're correct. All right, whatever. It was stated that the gospel was not presented. And I have it, you know, I've got these little programs here, and these little programs play videos. It's amazing. You can actually play videos from stuff that happened in the past. These are recordings of events. And so you don't have to just, it's really neat. You don't have to just go on the basis of, you know, what people think. You can actually rewatch what was said over and over again. It's really cool how it works. It's great how that happens. And so I can just, you know, click on a few little things here on the screen, and we can all watch as Yasser Qadhi asks me in the mosque to explain why Jesus had to die and justification. And I have all this time, and I even took the time to contrast the Christian perspective with the hadith of the man who killed 99 people, which I've done in a number of my debates, but I did right there. And I did so in such a way as to be motioning toward Dr. Qadhi, and I was saying, well, for example, like the hadith of the man who killed 99 people. And I was wanting, if I in any way misrepresented that hadith, please feel free. And no, he was just nodding his head. Yep, that's what it says. And for a lot of folks, that's an amazing thing to watch. They've never seen that before. They've never seen a Muslim scholar in an imam in a mosque sitting with a Christian who is narrating the Muslim hadith, and he agrees with his narration. It's an accurate narration. He's accurately representing what it says, what it means, and presenting in such a way that it communicates to Muslim people. Now, one of the problems a lot of people have is, and again, this goes back a ways, but for years and years now, this ministry has been involved in witnessing to Mormons. And people who are now parents with teenage kids were once kids themselves who went out with us to the Mormon temple, and they can testify very, very clearly that for decades, I have taught people that you have to overcome language barriers in witnessing to people from other faith perspectives. Some people don't even like the idea of faith perspectives, but, you know, from another religious viewpoint, whatever. And you have to overcome language barriers, because the danger is they may hear you using certain language and interpret it in such a way that they will put a meaning into your words that you don't want there, and that will end up sort of short-circuiting what you're attempting to do. You may think they're following, and then half an hour into the conversation, everything goes off the rails. You wonder what happened, and what it was is you hadn't been communicating all along. And that's the problem. And so I sit in a mosque, and when I explain the necessity of Christ's death, I do so in such a way that I quote a hadith so as to present a contrast so that people can understand what the real difference is. And that's not the first time I've been in a mosque and explained that. There is a video out there. Mark Fitzpatrick. Okay, you're right. There is a video out there of me in the mosque in Erasmia, South Africa. And the debate was on salvation. And so one of the issues that had to be dealt with was, to me, and I think to serious Muslims as well, one of the key issues is, can God forgive sin without his law being propitiated? And Islam says yes. That's what the whole story of the man that killed 99 people, actually it's 100 by the time I got done. That's the whole point, is that Allah can arbitrarily forgive egregious mass murderers with his law remaining broken. No justice done. God's law does not require justice in Islam. And when you think about it, there are a lot of Christians that struggle with this issue. When you ask them, well, you've accepted the idea that atonement is necessary. You may have accepted it when it was presented to you as a child. You may have accepted it when you presented it to you as a young adult, whenever it is you accepted the message. But a lot of Christians are really befuddled when you press the issue and say, why? Why can't God just forgive? Why does his law have to be fulfilled? Why is it necessary for there to be atonement? What you've got to deal with this when you're dealing with Muslims, if you're dealing with Muslims. Majority of my critics aren't dealing with Muslims. They may encounter Muslims, they may pass out a tract, they may say, repent and believe the gospel, but that's not dealing with Muslims. Actually engaging them, their worldview, their beliefs, so that the gospel is understandable to them, that's a different issue. That's a different issue. It's real easy to talk to people on the street, have a five-minute conversation, go, yeah, I'm really engaging the Muslim people. No, you're not. That may start something, but if you can't go beyond that, if you can't get to this level of discussing, of even answering the question, why is atonement necessary? Then you're not really engaging the subject. So anyway, what's really neat is I have right here on this wonderful computing device, this videotape where I can replay what I actually said over and over again. And we can listen and we can go, look, the gospel is presented. Look, I talked about things like repentance and faith and atonement and justification, the nature of justification and the relationship of faith and works. Wow, I got to say more about the gospel in that mosque than most people say in sermons in their churches on Sunday mornings. How did that happen? That's amazing. Yeah. So it's 877-753-3341 for those gentlemen. But they're not going to call because it's a slam dunk. And they know it. So they have their purposes for what they're doing. They have their, you know, and it wouldn't promote their purposes to actually have to deal with what was said, because not a single one of them has ever been in that situation and ever will be in that situation and has given anywhere near as complete or clear a presentation as was done in what they are calling a huge act of compromise and sin on my part. So there you go. There you go. But the phone lines are open. You could keep an eye on those for those little blinking lights. You could, good. Okay, good, good. So we tested them, made sure they worked and everything. Yeah. Couple other things. Look, when this level of attack begins, there are certain people in the internet. There's one individual, for example, the vilest internet troll ever known to man. He is the world record holder and always will be. If you even start talking about him in the chat channel, I will ban you. This man defines vile. There is no one that I know of in my entire life of any religion that I despise more than this individual. Okay, what this individual has said in public forums concerning me and my family and people like that. I'm not even going to mention it. I wouldn't repeat such things. But there is no one, nobody on the planet as vile as this man that I've ever met in my life. He's crawled out of whatever hole he lives in to start spitting and throwing dirt and all the rest of that kind of stuff. And people are picking up on that. It is an amazing thing that you can spend all these years doing the things that we've been doing, and what's happening in that process is there are people out there that just become embroiled in their anger and their hatred, just waiting for the opportunity. And evidently, the Lord wanted to teach me something, because when you see this kind of vitriol and hatred every single day, what it does is it has tremendously focused my mind on the people who have stood with me and the friends that I have and the value of having friends who stand with you when the last thing that it's popular to do is to actually stand up and say, "Hey, what are you people doing? This is crazy." Because we're seeing a lot of stuff. We're seeing the destructive interface of politics and different kinds of politics with the Christian faith. You start mixing the state with the church. I don't care if it was in Rome. I don't care if it was Constantine or Constantius or Constance or Theodosius or anybody else. Once you start that mixture, bad things happen. Bad things happen. But man, if you even mention that, I mean, look, I'll just mention a very, very large church last week or the week before last had some big honking patriotic celebration. Fireworks in the sanctuary. Fireworks. Serious. I mean, serious. Somehow they managed to do that without torching the place. I really wonder if the fire marshal's a member of the church. Probably is this church. Because I don't know how that would really be even safe, to be honest with you. I really, really don't. Anyway, I'm being distracted by something in channel right now. I don't know what it's about. Mubin? What's Mubin? I've used Mubinun, which means clear. I'm not sure what. Anyway, don't have time to try to catch up with stuff in the channel, but there were flags everywhere, and everybody's wearing red, white, and blue, and there are American flags just being waved all over the place, and fireworks going off, and this is a service of worship to the one triune God who is the God of all people. All people. Now, I didn't listen to the sermon, so I can't be completely critical. But I'll just tell you right now, if I'm considered to be an elder in any church, that ain't ever happening in any church that I'm an elder at. No way. Mm-mm, no, that's no. I no. But even if it did, in someone's church, it would be absolutely necessary that in anything like that, you would have a complete call. A complete call to repentance on the part of this nation. I have seen pictures of our flag flying over our embassies in foreign countries with the gay pride flag right beneath it. This nation is using its treasure and its money to promote sexual perversion around the world. This nation has spit in God's face and redefined marriage. This nation spits in God's face every day and murders unborn children. This nation has not yet quite gotten to the point, but man, they're trying to get there, of criminalizing, well, New York has, but it just hasn't gotten outside of the crazy spots yet, but it will, to follow Canada's line in criminalizing you if you use the wrong pronouns of someone. By the way, that is so insane. That is so utterly insane and completely unworkable. It would end human communication. I mean, you just couldn't talk to people. You could no longer talk to people. You couldn't communicate with people. You just have to ignore people. And of course, they'd probably make that illegal too. But if they're going to go there, I'm going to come up with my own set of pronouns. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to use Greek. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to grab the most difficult, let's say, first declension pronouns. I'm going to pull something from Greek that will be so esoteric that anyone who tries to talk to me will automatically go to jail. Just gone. Why not? Why not? I mean, if that's how insane this world has become, why not? Look, if there is not a call in that service for a recognition that what this nation needs is not for us to be sitting there waving our flags and going, yay, USA! It's for Christians? We should be mourning. Mourning at what has happened in our land. Mourning at the love of sin and rebellion and the depth of degradation that has taken place in this land. Anyway, lots of unpopular things that we could be talking about. Looks like Paul Flynn is trying to get his own block server as well. That's from people that are on Twitter are telling me, hey, look, I got blocked too. Wow. I guess there are actually some apps you can buy that will block all the followers of someone you don't like. I haven't seen it, but someone's told me about it. And maybe that's what these people are doing, is I'm just going to block. The problem is I have over 30,000 followers on Twitter. So, like I said, you end up with your own server to hold your block list. But as I was saying, I've learned from this who my friends are, and certainly learned who my enemies are, and that I have a lot of them, but that there are people who will stand up and do what's right and see through all the craziness. Most of you know that a article was published on American Thinker over the weekend. I asked for the opportunity of responding and was turned down, of course. And Michael Brown was aware of this. And so he's attempting to get an article because he's got a lot more contacts as far as the publishing industry is concerned. And we're still hoping to get something. They'll only give him less than half the space, even if anything happens. And I don't, I'll be honest with you, we've sort of got a little joke going. He's the optimist. I said my middle name is Eeyore. So if he does get something published on American Thinker, then he wins on that one. But I don't think it's going to happen. But he sent me the article he originally wrote and gave to them, which was a little bit shorter than the original thing. And they're like, ah, it's way too long, blah, 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 blah. But I read it, and it was great. And just extremely touching that he would take the time to write something like this and weigh in on this and do research. And it's going to get published one way or the other. Obviously, he has other avenues of publishing that he can utilize, but it's going to be out there hopefully within the next couple of days. Obviously, I'll be linking to it in regards to our social media accounts and things like that. I'll be letting people know how they can get hold of it as well. But it should be out probably by tomorrow at the latest, anyways. And so I'm extremely appreciative of that. There have been a few in my own tribe who have stood up and said things. Most, I think, are probably in my tribe anyways, not even aware of it. But yeah, there's a number of folks, you know, you would have assumed would have thought the best of you that didn't. It is interesting. I saw someone make note that they had said a few months ago that I'm concerned that James White seems to be nicer to Muslims than he is to Christians. And this has been said a couple times, and I've commented on air more than once. Folks, I hold Christians to a much higher standard than I do anyone else. Don't you? I mean, seriously. I want to believe the best of someone, but when it comes to truthfulness or consistency or whatever else, I expect Christians to act like Christians. And so, but even then, the idea seems to be if you disagree with someone's perspective, and a lot of this goes back to the text issue. Amongst Reform folks, at least some Reform folks, it goes back to this issue of the TR, ecclesiastical text, King James stripe, whatever it might be. And since I've said, look, folks, this is dangerous. This is highly corrosive and destructive to the apologetic defense of the New Testament, etc. Well, that makes me a terrible, horrible, mean, nasty person. And that means I'm meaner to Christians than I am to Muslims. Well, that's funny. I mean, you know, my fundamental conclusions and my arguments about Islam is that it's not true, period. The Quran does not come from God, and Muhammad was not a prophet, and there are reasons for that you don't have to, you know, light yourself on fire and act like a complete jerk to be able to explain to people. But how is it that saying this position, let's say ecclesiastical textism, how is it that saying, I think this is destructive to the apologetic work of the church, I'm going to warn people? Where have I said any of these people aren't Christians? I don't get it. Where have I come to within one tenth of the level of the vitriol that is aimed at me constantly over the past few weeks by so many people? I just don't. So I haven't quite followed that, but be that as it may, fascinating as it is. Would you be interested in doing Mormon evangelism here in St. George, Utah? Well, I've driven through St. George around the temple. Yeah, you know, I used to do that type of thing all the time. I wish I still had that opportunity. Maybe someday. But thanks, Zachary. That'd be fun to get back out there again. The only problem, Zachary, is I tend to attract an interesting crowd. I mean, literally, I have to do sort of hit and run witnessing. And what I mean by that is, you know, I can go out. I went out to the temple for the first time in years, one night in Mesa. But I couldn't tell people I'm going to be out there because I attract interesting people. That's what stopped our outreach in Salt Lake City and Mesa. The King James only street screechers would show up, and it just destroyed everything. And unfortunately, that would probably, you know, happen again. But it's possible to do a one-time thing once in a while. But yeah, I haven't been through there for a while. I I remember driving up from down there to Salt Lake once in the 1972 Camaro. I found this used Camaro, and it was one that had one of those rag tops on it, and the top had decayed out, and the whole roof was just full of holes. And a friend at church had to come in and use that stuff you stuff into walls and filled it all. It was, and then buff it down. Oh, it looked horrible, but it was still a Camaro, man. And it had a V8 350, I think. And I remember driving up there through Utah. I'd have to plan my stops so there would be a checker or something like that, because I had one cylinder that would foul all the time, and so I'd have to keep replacing the spark plug, you know, at regular intervals. And oh man, it was so much fun back then. Sort of like when Mike Bellavault and I drove my 64? Was that a 64 Dodge Dart? Was my Dart a 64? I think it was a 64 Dodge Dart up to Salt Lake City. And we had to stop at Lake Powell at the dam to dig socks out from the back of the car because there were so many holes in the floorboard that the cold air is coming through and freezing our feet. Yeah, it's we've got lots of funny stories we can tell about stuff like that. But anyway, what can I say? Now everybody is posting their block pictures. we're gonna bring Twitter down. That's just all there is to it. We're gonna destroy Twitter because the block list will become so long that the whole system is just gonna bog down and it's just gonna die, and that'll pretty much end everything. Wow, Von Tischendorf just joined the chat channel. I'm not sure if that's legal because that's like a necromancy or something. Because I happen to know that Constantine von Tischendorf is in. Well, I believe he's in heaven. I believe he's obviously a believer, a very strong believer, a conservative believer, actually. So he couldn't be joining channel. So that's strange. Yes, sir? Nothing? Oh, okay. All right. So there's all that stuff. So we're just going to keep an eye on the thing here and go on to other subjects. I announced earlier that I was going to, that I had the opportunity of hearing not the last issue of Unbelievable. Justin's got a new book out. Congratulations, Justin. I don't know that Justin would want to come on the program right now to talk about anything. I'm not sure he'd want to have me on the program right now to talk about anything. But anyway, we may have Justin on. I don't know. Justin might be a little bit nervous to come on with me because I happen to know that Justin and I don't necessarily see eye to eye on everything, and he might have to, you know, but be careful, Justin. I could buy your book and listen to it on a ride and go, oh, okay, all right, let's have a little talk. But anyway, prior to the release of Justin's new book, which I'm sure would be a very interesting read, Justin Brierley, called Unbelievable, something about, but it's 10-year history of the program, and after talking to atheists for 10 years, why am I still a Christian, and things like that. Free little plug there for Justin Brierley. The program before that had Mike Lycona on it with Dr. Burridge, and this was not a debate at all because they are almost smack on with one another. Burridge, being British, is probably a little bit farther to the left from Lycona, but not much. And it was on Why Do the Gospels Differ? So in other words, it was about Lycona's new book. And I'm not doing this to start engaging everything that was said either about the book or that topic. But I did want to play a portion and do a little interaction with it. And I'm not going to speed it up or anything, because sometimes Americans have problems with British accents. Well, not like Lycona has one, but let's just listen in. This is from the Unbelievable radio broadcast from a couple weeks ago. And Mike. Oh, and it would help if I had remembered to replug it. Here we go.
And my concern with the problems that a lot of Christians get into, and why I totally support and share Mike's perspective to try to help Christians understand the Bible, is that many Christians are bothered, as just said, by these differences. And if you think that the Bible is a kind of video diary, and then there's two blind men in one gospel and only one in the other, well, one's true and one's not. But what we're doing there is confusing truth with facticity.
Right.
And I totally, you know, back to my arguments with your dad, totally agree with Mike that the crucial things that Jesus rose from the dead and is alive, that's true.
Yeah.
I think it's also a fact.
Yeah.
The way in which facts are treated in the ancient world and the way in which facts are treated today are very different. And what Mike has done is to show the way in which the differences in the Gospels are not in any shape or form any more significant differences than the differences written by Plutarch.
I mean, this is obviously the essential thing, and perhaps just before I invite people to email in with their thoughts on this, this kind of does revolve around the whole idea of, you know, are we obliged in some way to view the Gospels and the Bible generally as inerrant, you know, and or is that a somewhat modern category of thinking about the Bible which does rather impose, I guess, 21st century.
I'm going to say that inerrancy is a 19th century heresy.
Right. You've put it out there, Rich.
I
look forward to the avalanche of emails.
Well, for instance, when does the ascension happen? If you read Luke's Gospel, Luke chapter 24, he takes us through the events of the first Easter day. Jesus rises from the dead in the morning. He goes for a walk on the road to Emmaus in the afternoon. He meets with everybody, and after dinner that evening, he ascends into heaven. In part two in the book of Acts, he has a period of 40 days. Well, either you have to say that Luke is stupid and doesn't realize he said something different at the end of his Gospel or the start of the book of Acts, or you have to say he's actually not writing what we understand by chronology.
Okay.
He's more theological than he's chronological. What he wants to do is to talk about the truths, and I think they are truths, and I think they're facts, that Jesus rose from the dead, that Jesus met with his disciples, and that Jesus reigns with God in heaven. And those facts don't depend upon the timing of when he took off.
Just your perspective on this, because I know, Mike, you know, it's been well documented that certain other scholars in the States have come after you for the way you've kind of looked at some of the stories around the resurrection and things like that, and not necessarily affirmed a kind of strictly, you know, inerrancy kind of view necessarily that others, at least the way others would interpret that. I mean, what's your take on this? Are there other words you would prefer to use than inerrancy, perhaps? How do you approach this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I suppose some of it depends on how one wants to define inerrancy. Some of the definitions of inerrancy, many of them here in America, are difficult to swallow. So, for example, most American evangelicals sitting in the pew think of inerrancy as every word in our present Bible being true. But they would be surprised to learn that most evangelical scholars here don't even hold that. In fact, an ultra-conservative scholar here named Norman Geisler, one of the guys who
came after you,
was attacking me, he even acknowledges that the Bible we have in our hands today contains mistakes due to scribal errors, and that the doctrine of inerrancy, in his mind, only applies to the autographs. The problem is we no longer have the autographs. So in a very real sense, a rigid definition of inerrancy is nothing more than having a firm grasp on an empty sack. In contrast, the Lausanne Covenants...
Now let's stop there, because there's plenty to deal with right there. There were so many things, and it was fascinating, because one of the examples that was given by the participants was the idea. See what Lycona has done is he's looked at Plutarch's Lives, where he provides a great deal of information about various individuals from the ancient world. And what's useful is sometimes he does that from different perspectives. And so he might mention somebody in one, and then somebody else's life that intersected with that one. It's sort of like the Gospels, where you get some interaction, and you can see how at times he will telescope, or he will abbreviate, or he'll include details in one place and not in the other place. It's a standard observations. I'm sorry, it's really not anything new, in the sense that this was stuff that I was exposed to in seminary in the 80s. So I'm not sure why it makes it all that new. But anyway, that's what the book is about, is these are mechanisms that Plutarch used to communicate this genre of historical biography, and that's what we should do with the Gospels as well. Well, in some instances, the conclusions are exactly the same. When you have differences in the number of people present, and that was the example used there. Burridge talks about, well, if you have one person or two, one's right, one's wrong. No, that's that kind of simplistic, shallow interpretation. I suppose there are people like that out there. The problem is that it seems that these individuals, especially in Europe, conflate any kind of desire to harmonize and to hold a meaningful doctrine of inerrancy. And they'll use the worst, most simplistic examples rather than the best, most thought out, meaningful, and scholarly examples that are found throughout commentaries that have been written for decades and centuries. And that's very troubling. For example, Lycona's comment there at the end, that having a firm grasp on inerrancy is having a firm grasp on an empty bag, where he's clearly confusing categories. And what's fascinating, and I can't go into details right now, but I am doing a debate, a written debate with someone. And instead of going the Lycona direction in dealing with the issue of inerrancy and textual issues, there are people that go the other direction. And that is, they establish a particular set of manuscripts or a particular edition of manuscripts as their inerrant standard and solve the problem that way. So the liberal just throws it all out like Ehrman does. And then there's others who refusing to recognize the difference between inerrancy of the autographs and copyist issues and conflating those. And they'll actually very often, the conservatives will blame B.B. Warfield. They'll say Warfield came up with all this stuff about inerrancy. Warfield came up with the distinction between the autographs and what comes afterwards, and it's all Warfield's fault. Warfield is just recognizing what people have understood from the beginning. You know, when Burridge calls this an 18th century, I forget which one he said, heresy. It shows you how many New Testament guys don't do any church history. They just don't do any church history. The terminology is one thing. The understanding of what it means is another thing. And it's very, very obvious that the early church functioned upon a doctrine of inerrancy, the nature of Scripture, what it is. It's too easy to document that. There are a number of places you can even go online. There's stuff on Triablog on that. Jason Engwer has written stuff like on that for years, literally. And I, in fact, now I think about it, I think he actually commented on this thing. I think I saw something about it. Anyway, you can discuss those things. But so it's striking that one who would be considered one of the leading scholarly apologists in the United States would say that a firm grasp of inerrancy is a firm grasp of an empty sack, all because of the lack of the autographs. I mean, that to, of everything that I heard, you know, I know that N.T. Wright refers to inerrancy as that silly American doctrine. Burridge just calls it, you know, 19th century heresy. He even said something about Americans at some point along the line. Their understanding of what inerrancy actually means seems to be somewhat prejudiced. And I have said, I have specifically made comment on this program, having played extensive portions of Mike Lycona's comments, that I think he just needs to come straight out and say, I don't believe in inerrancy. I believe that the Bible is primarily reliable, or go ahead and do the European thing, that the Bible accurately communicates to us spiritual truths. That's what Rome does. And just go ahead and divorce the spiritual stuff from the historical reality that gives it meaning, because that's what you got to do. I mean, I'm not saying anything that people haven't said for a long, long time. If you go back to the 1970s, go back to the fine books that were written back then on inerrancy by some leading scholars at the time, they go into depth on these things. There's nothing new here. It's just that people don't read those books anymore. That's a shame. So, but that was very troubling to hear, to someone, ignore the distinctions that need to be made. But it is fascinating that people want, instead of trying to hold together through thoughtful analysis and consideration, the reality of what scripture being theanoustos must mean, what it must mean in regards to the nature of revelation, with the reality of the mechanism that God has used to preserve his word. The mechanism they used was not chiseling it in stone on a mountaintop so there's only one copy. And if someone ever tries to copy it down, they're zapped by lightning. That would take care of textual variation. But it really doesn't work when you're trying to have the gospel spread all across the world. So, as Dan Wallace has said more than once, there are a lot of people that are willing to trade truth for certainty. And so the two sides you can fall off on is the Bart Ehrman side, where you just throw inerrancy out, and he goes so far as to throw the supernatural nature of Scripture out. And then the other side, well, we can't have, if our doctrine of inspiration says that what is given extends to the very words, then we need to have the autographs. And since we don't have the autographs, we all admit that, then we'll recreate them. We'll recreate them. And so you have the low-level King James only, frequently King James only cultic perspective, which says the Bible was re-inspired between 1604 and 1611, somehow, mechanism unknown. To a higher level, well, we need to have an authoritative text. And so in light of the great work of the Spirit of God in the Reformation and the codification of Reformed theology, you have the Textus Receptus, or sort of the various texts that make up the Textus Receptus, something along those lines. And so you don't just crudely say re-inspiration, but it ends up having the same impact, basically. And those are the two extremes. The reality is where you remain balanced. And you affirm the truth, even if the resultant situation requires you to make very careful and appropriate distinctions between categories. We have to deal with the Trinity. Why shouldn't we have to deal with our bibliology? Well, because that's too hard. Well, I'm sorry if some folks find it hard, but there you go. All through this dialogue, again, you had this real simplistic view of the other side. Instead of interacting, it would have been really nice if you had somebody on that could really interact with this from a meaningful perspective from the other side. But you had this, it's very, very clear that the idea of harmonization is a bugaboo if you want to be accepted at the scholarly table. And again, it's real easy to present examples where people have tried to harmonize stuff that, A, didn't need to be harmonized, and the suggested harmonization is just absurd. Bart Ehrman did this. I remember which underpass I was going on the canal when the first time I heard him in one of his classes, one of those, what was that, great class, is it called Great Classes or something like that? Anyways, he was talking about I think it was the raising of Jairus's daughter. And he said that the fundamentalist harmonization was to say that she died twice and was raised twice. And so all the differences between the stories is taken care of by saying, well, this happened more than once. No discussion of telescoping, anything like that was presented by Ehrman. It was clearly an attempt to basically mock the perspective of even trying to harmonize these materials. So it's real easy to do that, but seriously, the early church struggled with this issue, and I think part of it, again, is the modernistic, we're so much smarter than everybody in the early church was, that they didn't think of anything that we've ever thought of, and we're so intelligent, and blah, blah, blah. There is a element of truth, and I've mentioned this many times before, there's an element of truth to the statement that if you harmonize the four Gospels, what you end up with isn't any one of the Gospels. So they always point to Tatian's Diatessaron, which was an early church conglomeration of the four Gospels into one story. Sometimes pulling from this one, sometimes pulling from that one, et cetera, et cetera. And I would agree that that's inappropriate and that you do end up with something that basically is not inspired. That's not what Matthew wrote. That's not what Mark wrote. Luke, John, obviously. But, and the church rejected the Diatessaron. I mean, it was used as sort of like a harmony of the Gospels type thing, but it was rejected as a basis for preaching or anything like that, because it's not what any of the apostles actually wrote. So the element of truth is you want to have the Gospels, and Matthew has a reason for saying what Matthew says, and Mark and Luke and John, we affirm that. I mentioned a number of times I've taught through the Synoptic Gospels in the Synoptic format using a harmony. So you have the Gospels right there. You can't exactly skip over the differences between the texts. They're right there in front of you. And so I have, taught my classes the basic elements of looking at context, the intention of the writer, all the rest of these types of things. And in a lot of the things that Lycona comes up with, we would agree. If you've got the story of James and John and their mother, right? And in one story, it's James and John that come, and the other, it's their mother that comes. Ah, see, factually, the mother's representing James and John. So one author simply says, gives a specific identity of the person that comes. The other, they center, so that was them saying it. And for those that purpose, that's how you do it, so on and so forth. If I were to, say to Rich, hey, tell such person when he calls X, Y, and Z, then you could say, I said that to him, or if you want to say it, that Rich said that to him. It just depends on what level of specificity you're attempting to write. It's going to be accurate either way. It's going to be truthful either way. Nothing really new about those things. But what we've seen with Lycona and others is a willingness to not only appropriately recognize when you have things like that, or appropriately recognize when you have telescoping, such as in the raising of Jairus' daughter. And I explained this in the debate with Shabir Ali in 2006. This is not something that's new. We've been discussing these things for a long, long time, and of course, they've been discussed for centuries and centuries before now. But Lycona is willing to basically say, yeah, there are errors. And obviously Burridge would go farther than that. That there are factual errors, but that the overall message remains true. Well, we've seen the results of that within the Roman Catholic Academy. We've seen the results of that perspective within liberal Protestantism. And I don't think it actually ends up answering any of the questions, to be perfectly honest with you. But that's the direction that this seems to be going within this particular apologetic perspective. And it's interesting, I didn't play it right here, but later on, and what I want to try to do, we're going to have to wait until I get back to do this. Like I said, I'm heading out of town. But a number of years ago, I gave a presentation at a conference back in New York, and I went through Bart Ehrman's attacks on the Gospels. One of the things I did is I went through John's relationship to the Synoptics. And I guess I'm just going to have to give that presentation on the program again. I may have done it sometime in the past, but I'm going to probably have to do it again, because this was one of the issues that came up was, basically, it's like, well, you know, John changes history for theological purposes. He changes really when the crucifixion took place. Well, I'm sorry, but if you start changing when the crucifixion took place and when things happened, the intimate connection that exists between the historicity of the Gospel events and the recording of them, the communication of them, is broken. It's lost. You end up with myth. And that's very, very concerning to me. Very, very concerning. Well, like I said, I will try to remember when we get back. I still have that presentation that I used years ago. It was a Jeremiah Cry thing. It was a Jeremiah Cry thing in New York. So you can probably, it may still be on YouTube someplace. Put up Jeremiah Cry, James White, New York. It might come up. I don't know. It was recorded. I don't know if it was ever put on YouTube. But, well, and actually, I also did it at, I also did that presentation at Covenant of Grace Church in St. Louis about 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 4 or 5. When you've been going to the same place for 15 years, after a while, you start losing track of exactly when it was. But anyway, but we'll probably do it on the program so we can do it a little more slowly. And, you know, really go into depth on the issue, because the reality is there is simply no reason to think that John is in contradiction to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Well, Justin tried to, it came up in my dialogue with Yusuf Ismail. And there's just no way to briefly summarize all the information about the nature of the Passover. The Passover wasn't just one single meal. It was a multi-day celebration. And the evidence that I think is very clear that John is in agreement with Matthew, Mark, and Luke on the date of the crucifixion, which day of the week it was. I think it's specifically stated that it was the day of preparation. And I have a Greek-speaking fellow who attends my Sunday school class. I got to use him this last Sunday. I wrote Auta Theos on the board. We were talking about post-Nicene Christological orthodoxy and Calvin's reaction to it. And I wrote up there and I said, so, what does that mean? And it looks like a self-God. I said, yeah, there you go. But I had asked him what the word for Friday in Greek is. It's Preparation Day. John says it happened on Preparation Day. It's pretty clear. Anyways, we'll go through that and deal with that. So we can definitely do that. And I think it'll be helpful to folks. But even putting out that kind of effort just removes you from the table in much of modern New Testament scholarship. You're not going to get published if you basically say, hey, you know what? We actually got it right 1,600 years ago. That's the problem with the kind of scholarship that we have today and the process is that it doesn't encourage remaining orthodox. It encourages coming up with something new. And when you're talking about a divine revelation and a completed revelation, something new is going to be a heresy. We can go deeper in our knowledge of what's been given, but you're just not going to get published if basically what you say is, you know what? Yeah, the best in-depth harmonizations that have been given before that aren't trying to play games, that are taking seriously the intentions of each other, yeah, they seem to work. Okay, not going to get a book contract or article in a journal for something like that. You need to come up with something new, and that's what people are doing. So it was interesting, and like I said, I want to spend a little more time on some of the examples a little bit later on. So I went a little bit over there. Sorry about that. I thought I was right on time, so I looked at the screen and went, oh, okay. Sorry about that. So I saw you on the phone out there. You weren't talking to anybody that, no. Okay, well, I guess that means the gospel was clearly presented, and there you go. I'm sure that Brandon House and all, they'll be pulling down their videos and posting apologies, and yeah, I'm not holding my breath. Not holding my breath. Thanks for watching Dividing Line today. I don't know when we're going to be back, but I've done it from Colorado before, so we'll try to do it again. Lord willing, we'll see you whenever. God bless.